At the close of the 19th Congress of the Communist Party in Moscow in 1952, Khrushchev, who is now one of the powerful rulers of the Soviet Union, ended his speech with the following words: "Long live the wise leader of the party and of the people, the inspirer and the organizer of all of our victories, Comrade Stalin." At the close of the 20th Congress of the Communist Party in Moscow in 1956, Khrushchev devoted his entire closing speech to a denunciation of Stalin as a savage, half-mad, power-crazed despot. His all-out attack upon Stalin exceeded anything in virulence that anti-communists had ever said of Stalin. Now, what happened between 1952 and 1956? One simple event occurred. Stalin died in 1953. Stalin died in 1953, and they have been assassinating him ever since. These men did not have the courage to do it, to criticize him during his lifetime. They were afraid of this ruthless dictator who dispatched his opponents in short order. And they quaked in his presence. Marshal Bulganin, another one of the powerful rulers of the Soviet Union today, once remarked, "It has happened sometime that a man goes to Stalin on his invitation as a friend, and when he sits with Stalin, he does not know whether he will be sent next home or to jail." And so these associates of Stalin, who sought to make the whole world tremble by their might, these associates chose to remain the craven sycophants of Stalin, obeying his every whim, overlooking and justifying his every crime, and permitting themselves to be used by him for every dirty purpose. In fact, they vied with one another in what Khrushchev now calls the loathsome adulation of this man, Stalin. They knowingly helped to build up the myth of Stalin. Stalin as the all-wise, the genius, the beloved leader, the father, the savior of the people. They conspired with him to rewrite and deliberately to falsify history in order to extol Stalin and to blacken the names of those heroes of the Russian Revolution whom Stalin came to hate and whom he proceeded ruthlessly to liquidate. And for years, these brave revolutionaries, the Khrushchevs and the Bulganins, the Molotovs, the Vyshinskis, were Stalin's most loyal lieutenants and his most abject flunkies and apologists. But now that Stalin is dead, they would like to be known again as courageous men. Now they are prepared to tell the truth about Stalin and his regime of 30 years. The truth which, by the way, was well known, though not in all details, of course, to the free world right along. But the truth which was kept from the Soviet people by as thoroughgoing a conspiracy of silence and suppression and propaganda as was ever recorded in the annals of mankind. I wish I had the time to read the full text of the speech of Khrushchev at this Congress of the Communist Party last February. It was fully reported in the world's press. And it is not only a devastating account of Stalin himself and therefore of the Communist Party rule of the Soviet Union during three decades up to Stalin's death, a rule based on terror and torture and suppression and brutality, but also this speech is a shocking self-indictment of the very men who now make this amazing revelation. Here is a brief digest of that speech taken from one of the newspapers. He printed the speech in full. In the last years of his 30 years reign as Soviet dictator, Stalin was guilty of a grave abuse of power. He practiced brutality and violence towards everyone who opposed him. This is using almost literally the words of Khrushchev. He demanded absolute submission to his own opinion and applied mass repression, not only to enemies of the regime, but also against loyal communists. Many innocent persons became his victims. They were subjected to barbaric tortures. It was he who originated the concept of enemy of the people. This concept eliminated any possibility of making a fight for one's views. The main proof of guilt used against accused enemies was their extorted confessions. Abandoning methods of persuasion and education, Stalin resorted to administrative violence and terror. He acted on an increasing wider scale. All this he did in 1935 and afterward, when the Bolshevist Revolution had already been well established and its class enemies destroyed. Mass arrests and deportations, executions without trial and without normal investigation, created conditions of insecurity fear, and even desperation. Using his unlimited powers, Stalin acted in the name of the Central Committee of the Communist Party without even asking its opinion. 70% of the Central Committee's members and candidates elected at the 17th Congress of the party, 70% were arrested and shot, mostly in 1937 and 1938. Very distrustful and pathologically suspicious, Stalin would look at a man and say, "Why are your eyes so shifty today?" Everywhere, in everything, he saw enemies, spies, and hypocrites. Grievous consequences resulted from his suspiciousness, for it led to the annihilation of many military commanders in a purge that extended down even to the commanders of companies and battalions. Not only did Stalin weaken the Soviet Union's military capacity, but he also refused to believe warnings from Prime Minister Winston Churchill of Britain and others that Germany was preparing to attack the Soviet Union in 1941. And once the attack started, Stalin ceased to do anything. When he finally aroused himself, his nervousness and hysteria caused serious damage to the army. He never understood the situation because he never visited the front. He planned military operations on a globe, not on a military map. His order to carry out the encirclement of Kharkov in 1942 cost the Soviet army hundreds of thousands of men. That was Stalin's military genius. That is what it cost the Soviet Union. And after the war, Stalin became even more capricious and irritable and brutal. His persecution mania reached unbelievable dimensions. His monstrous mistakes and mania for greatness also caused a break with Yugoslavia. Of Tito, the Soviet leader said, "I will shake my little finger and there will be no more Tito. He will fall." And the Soviet Union has paid dearly for that little shake. Stalin also issued the orders for the arrest of those involved in the so-called doctor's plot. He told the man in charge of the investigation, "If you do not obtain confessions from the doctors, we will shorten you by a head." These are the words not of a Western anti-communist. These are the words of the present ruler of the Soviet Union, spoken before a party congress and applauded by the members of that congress. There are other choice morsels to be found in the full text, which are not mentioned in this brief digest. This speech of Khrushchev lasted 2 days. At the time of his death, Stalin was embarked upon a plot to wipe out all the old members of the top Kremlin leadership. Stalin said Khrushchev was in the habit of signing execution orders in advance for defendants who had not yet even been charged by the police. Stalin complained in 1936 that the secret police were 4 years behind their quota in making arrests. And he dismissed one chief after another in order to speed up his purges. To the question which has puzzled the Western world during and since the notorious trials, you may recall, of the 30s, why did the old Bolshevik leaders confess the crime did not commit. Khrushchev now gives the answer. And the answer he summarizes in just these few words, and then explains them. The few words are beat, beat, and once again, beat. How is it possible that a person confesses to a crime which he has not committed, Mr. Khrushchev asked? Only in one way. Because of the application of physical methods of pressuring him, torture, bringing him to a state of unconsciousness, deprivation of his judgment, taking away of his human dignity. Mr. Khrushchev illustrated his object lesson on the machinery of Stalin's dictatorship with letter after letter drawn from the state archives. No Congress of the Communist Party was held during a period of 13 years, and seldom were the meetings of the Central Committee of the Communist Party called into consultation. Stalin was ignorant not only of military matters, but he was seemingly ignorant of many other things which were going on in the Soviet Union. Ignorant, for example, says Khrushchev, of the real agricultural conditions of Russia. He had no idea, Stalin, that Russia was facing a serious farm crisis. In 1952 and 1953, Stalin once proposed that a 40 billion ruble tax be levied on the collective farms and on their workers, although at that time the total farm sales to the government brought, brought these farmers only 26 billion of rubles. In such cases, said Mr. Khrushchev, facts and figures did not interest Stalin. If Stalin said anything, it meant it was so. After all, he was a genius, and a genius does not need to count. Now, these charges, which were frequently made by the free world against the communist regime and against Stalin during these 30 years, these charges of mass arrests in the Soviet Union, of wholesale deportations, murder, of bloody purges and liquidations, of manipulated trials, of confessions extracted by means of torture, of shameful miscarriage of justice, of government by plot and intrigue and treachery, all these manifestations of despotism have now been publicly confirmed by the rulers of Russia and by the ruling party of Russia. Now the question arises, why have these damaging confessions been made at this time? Why is the shameful story of a great country being ruled by one of the world's greatest criminals, by an egomaniac, by a paranoid, a man possessed of a persecution mania, sick for flattery, responsible for the death of millions, Why are communists in Russia making these revelations about the ruler of Russia? For 30 years. Well, the answer again is very simple. Stalin is dead. The pent-up resentment of the Russian people had to be diverted from those who aspire to be the new rulers of Russia. And so they placed all the evils, and the sufferings, and the miseries of the Russian people upon the scapegoat of Stalin, now dead, by way of exculpating themselves. By way of saying our hands did not spill this blood, it was he, Stalin, who was responsible for all your misfortunes. And more important, now that Stalin was dead, the question arose, who would be his successor? And acquired a number of people who aspired to the role of Stalin's successor, who were claimants to that position. Consequently, if a war of succession was to be averted, which would have resulted in the triumph of one man and the extermination of all the other unsuccessful candidates, and possibly also as a means of avoiding civil war, bloody civil war in the Soviet Union, then the institution of the one-man dictator had to be abandoned. But how abandon it? After the Russian people had been told over a number of years of the greatness of the one-man dictator Stalin, praised and extolled his victories and his triumphs and his achievements under his personal dictatorship. That dictatorship, therefore, had to be discredited. Even if they, the associates of Stalin, had to eat their own words. All the shortcomings and the weaknesses and the crimes of Stalin, the one-man rule, had to be exposed as completely and thoroughly as possible. If the cult of the individual, to use Khrushchev's phrase, if the cult of the individual was to be finally rejected by the Communist Party, there must now be collective rule, collective responsibility in the party. And so throughout this long address, this long harangue of Khrushchev, we find this note repeated over and over again. Comrades, he said, we must abolish the cult of the individual decisively, once and for all. We must draw the proper conclusions concerning both ideological, theoretical, and practical work. It is necessary for this purpose first, in a Bolshevik manner, to condemn and to eradicate the cult of the individual as alien to Marxism, Leninism, and not consonant with the principles of the party leadership and the norms of party life, and to fight inexorably all attempts of bringing back this practice in one form or another. The only trouble with this is that the despotic rule of the few in place of the one is no answer to the problems which the Stalin regime raised for Russia. Because the few rulers will sooner or later come to disagree on some irreconcilable issue or principle or practice or personality, and they will proceed to fight it out. Despotism does not attenuate itself by collectivizing bureaucratic control. And even a collective dictatorship cannot long maintain itself in power except through force and violence. As long as no opposition party is permitted to exist through which the disaffection of people can express itself peacefully, as long as the freedom to organize politically is denied to large sections of the population, as long as the freedom of speech is denied, so long must the one-party government in control employ sooner or later methods of suppression and tyranny in order to stay in power. There is no middle ground. These present rulers of Russia who have been downgrading Stalin, erasing his name from many public institutions, pulling down his statues, again rewriting history, the present rulers of Russia have not become, through their denunciation of the one-man rule of Stalin, champions of democracy or liberalism. They have not rejected the method of force. The method of brutal extermination of opposition was practiced by Lenin before the days of Stalin. Lenin exterminated opposition political parties. Lenin exterminated the kulaks. The present rulers of Russia are not advocating the granting of full freedom to the people of the Soviet Union to choose their own political leaders or their own government, to organize whatever political parties they wish, and to exercise the privilege of free speech and free thought and free assembly. They have not abandoned the Marxian concept of class struggle and the right to exterminate an opposition, and the building of socialism through dictatorship. They have simply expressed their concern with their own survival by asking for group dictatorship in place of unitary, single-man dictatorship. From the point of view of survival, a small group dictatorship is really weaker than a one-man dictator. For around a one-man dictator, it is quite possible to build up a personality cult, to romanticize that individual, to build a myth or a legend of greatness about him, so that he will have a certain mass support. It's quite possible to build up a myth around a Führer, around a Duce, around a little corporal, around a marshal, an individual. It's quite impossible to weave a halo of glory around an oligarchy. It is clear that the answer to the one-man dictatorship is not a multiple dictatorship. The answer is a no-man dictatorship. The answer is a government based not upon men at all, but upon just laws, safeguarded by a constitution which guarantees the fundamental, inalienable rights of all men. Where men are not free citizens, but manipulated robots, it matters very little whether it is a single or a multiple dictatorship which manipulates them. Now Russia has progressed in the last 30-odd years, to be sure. A dictatorship can go far in certain directions. Russia advanced very far under the dictatorship of Peter the Great, under some of the Tsars. But a fearful price is paid for this kind of one-sided progress under dictatorship. And in the case of Russia, that fearful price has now been told to the world by the very men who had a hand in paying that price, or in seeing that that price was paid. And unfortunately, these very men will have to continue to pay the same price for a time, perhaps in less obnoxious coins, for the same price of terror, suppression, liquidation, the denial of the fundamental rights to human beings. That price must be paid under any dictatorship. It was a wise writer and statesman who once declared, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. This is the inescapable lesson of history. This is the lesson that Russia is learning. This is the problem which Russia, the Russian people, will have to solve for themselves in the years to come. Perhaps the establishment of a weaker despotic control in the form of an oligarchy will open the door to a still further attenuation under the pressure of events of the autocratic rule of the Russian people. And one further lesson may be learned, and all that is being learned out of this, is a superb vindication of the democratic thesis. Another lesson which we well learn is that the end does not justify the means. That the way to achieve a desirable end must in itself be moral and just. That you can never achieve freedom through dictatorship. You can never achieve justice through acts of injustice and brutality. No ideal is so noble and so exalted and so desirable that it justifies the employment of methods of cruelty, oppression, and terror to accomplish it. It is better to go the slower way, the more deliberate way. But the way which reaches the goal ultimately without in the process sacrificing the basic rights and liberties of men. A democracy is not 100% efficient, and democracy hasn't achieved all that it has set out to achieve. There's still a long way to go, But in the process, because democracy employs methods of free men, because democracy permits men to express themselves, it has preserved for men a status of dignity, a spiritual integrity, which cannot exist under a dictatorship. And this status of self-respect, of dignity, is quite as important as the material gains which may come to men in the process of their advancement and their progress. A man does not live by bread alone. There must be bread also for the spirit of man and for his mind. In order to be happy, a man must be free. In order to be happy, a man must have a sense of self-esteem, of importance in the scheme of things. This is what a Bill of Rights grants to a free citizen. And this is what a dictatorship of one despot or a dozen despots can never give unto a people. It is well that communism has for the first time gone into the confessional and has beaten its breast and said, mea culpa. But its confessional, welcome as it is not enough and cannot be the last word. The Soviet Union, the peoples of the Soviet Union have a long way to go. They're a great people. The people capable of greatness. They have a long way to go in order to get back to the highway of civilization, the highway of liberty, and the rights of men to pursue their own happiness in their own way.